Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this Thursday, the 16th of January, 13 minutes past 9 o'clock. Listening to the music of the Westerlies, and you can find out more about them by going to at Westerlies Music. And, of course, see the various tracks that we play on this program on our playlist, which is posted online at wamc.org. We were having a very informal chat before the microphones went open and just saying, you know, today is not a slow news day. we have a lot to talk about, and it's almost one of those things like, well, where do you start? Well, we'll figure out a good starting place, but I'll have a couple of seconds to think about that while I introduce our wonderful panel this morning and remind you that you can be a part of the proceedings by simply writing to us, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. We'd love to hear your thoughts on the issues, the many issues that we will discuss over the next hour and a half or so. We also remind you that it is lockbox time. Whatever you can do to help the lockbox, we greatly appreciate it. The fund drive officially begins on February 3rd, and before that happens, we have a lot of work to do to fill the lockbox and to make sure, because every dollar that we make now is less than we're going to have to make and in taking over the airwaves beginning on February 3rd. So it behooves all of us to make this a very, very short drive by giving now and doing whatever you can. If you're going to do it anyway, why not now? WAMC.org, www.wamc.org, or 1-800-323-9262. Let me introduce our group to you. We welcome Jim Ketterer, Senior Fellow, Bard Center for Civic Engagement. Good morning, Jim. How are you?
Good morning. Nice to be here. I just want to say one thing about the lockbox. I've said it before, but I'll say it again. I have lived in countries where the press and communications are seriously controlled and constrained, and I've seen up close the toxic nature of that and the effects it has on society. So if you think it can happen here, you're wrong, and you should support this station because it's important to do your part, and it's important for this station to be able to continue to do its part.
Thank you very much. Those are kind words, and I appreciate them. I have to say, I was talking to someone last night, and they said, I got to tell you, Joe, I listen every day, but I just can't take it. I need a blackout for a while of news, you know. I got it, because otherwise I'm just gonna, you know, like roll up and die. And I said, well, I understand that, but by the same token, when you decide that you want to reemerge into society, you want to make sure that the station's still here. And they said, oh, you're right. So, you know, just keep checking in on us. Make sure we're still around, you know. Because
if you're going to check in.
Right. You don't do the Rip Van Winkle thing and then get up and find out that everything's changed. You don't want to do that either. But thank you. You can help out WAMC.org or 1-800-323-9262. Thrilled to see our good friend Aaron Pasitti, who is back, Siena College professor of economics. Good morning, Aaron. How are you?
Good morning. I'm doing well. I'm fully over my little bout with the flu, which was not fun. Thrilled to be here. And I just want to double down on what Jim said, but slightly different. We've clearly entered a post-truth society, whether it's the incoming president and his cabinet, whether it's social media, and that's a dangerous landscape. So being able to preserve areas where you can actually hear informed opinions that, you know, when people state their opinions, they say their opinions. They're not just making things up as if they are fact. And as somebody who's been on the roundtable for a long time, I really appreciate being able to come on and speak my mind and try to provide accurate information about the things I talk about. And it's unfortunate that spaces like that really are in decline. So contribute to the locked box, contribute to the fund drive, preserve the important institutions that sadly are in decline.
Thank you very much. Yes, it's hard to think, you know, when you compare us to anyone. And I know this may sound arrogant, and I don't mean it to be that way at all. But you know, it's like, if not us, who's going to do this? And to have conversations like we're about to have today, on in-depth conversations on issues that are in the news and beyond, then I think it's a rare place to come and to hear that, and we want to obviously preserve it if it is indeed what I think our listeners want, which I believe that it is. Libby Post is here today. She wasn't scheduled to be here, but we had another guest who telepathically got Aaron's flu, and so Libby came in the last moment on a white horse and is here to fill in. And good morning, thank you.
Good morning,
for being here.
Okay, so here's my thing about the lockbox.
Yeah,
you ready? I agree with Jim. I agree with Aaron, and I agree with Lynn, who gave $250 yesterday.
Nice.
So what I'm saying to all of you is, match us. Everybody out there, give at least $250, if not more. But you can match us. And, you know, I love this fun drive, but it takes away from hearing the facts and hearing
the day-to-day.
The day-to-day and keeping up. And, you know, it's going to be the first week in February, and that's going to be the third or second week of the felon-in-chief, the felon of the United States. That's what I'm going to call him from now on, is FOTUS, felon of the United States. You know, and so we need to know what's going on, and so we need to fill the lockbox now so we can hear the news later.
Absolutely, that's it. We endorse all of that, except for maybe
the what?
The felon part of the.
Well, but he is a felon.
Well, no, I'm just saying we're not going to call him that. You can do that.
I'm
going to
call him that.
You can call him.
Yeah,
that.
I know.
We're not going to do
that. It's like when I call
some
other people other things, and you get your
knickers
in a twist. I understand.
And off we go.
Yes, but your knickers are so sweet.
Good morning.
It's Thursday, it's Knickers Day.
Yeah, it's right. Knickers Day, that's right.
Or Snickers Day, if you want a sugar rush.
Well, let us begin with this. It's a very complex, complicated story, and so we'll do our best on it. As of, 9, 10 o'clock last night, the story that I was anticipating talking about today was a ceasefire deal that President Biden announced. And there was great fanfare over this, great joy, even at the time, it was certainly shadowed with great uncertainty. Well, now we're seeing in just updates that are coming out 5 minutes ago that disputes are holding up Israeli cabinet votes on the ceasefire deal after a period of cautious optimism. Benjamin Netanyahu's office said Hamas was reneging on parts of the deal, an accusation that the group rejected. So that starts us off into a bit of a different look at this. Last-minute disputes on Thursday appeared to hold up an expected Israeli cabinet vote on a ceasefire deal with Hamas, which after 15 months of devastating war in Gaza had raised hopes of ending the violence. By the afternoon, Israel had yet to convene ministers to discuss the proposal, citing disagreements with Hamas. The holdup prompted fears of further delays in implementing the agreement, which was announced on Wednesday. And Egypt, Qatar, that's not how Fred says it. How does Fred say it?
Fred, I think, and many say Qatar.
Qatar.
So the reason for that is that in the name of that country, there are two letters that we don't have in English. So the Q represents a Q that is in the back of the throat that is, a K sound that's in the back of the throat. And the T is also a T, but it's at the back of the throat, so it's Qatar. And then when you are saying it quickly, it almost sounds like a G.
Yes.
Qatar.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
But when people say Qatar or something like that, to transliterate it from Arabic into English, when you have two of the three letters that don't exist in English, makes it especially challenging.
All right, so we're going to go with...
So I gave you a little bit more than you wanted, probably.
No,
sorry.
No, that's fascinating. I didn't know that. That is.
I think we've already lost 90% of the listeners.
No, not at all. So this is this was the Hamas had agreed to a 42-day ceasefire and hostage release deal, raising hopes that a 15-month war that killed more than 46,000 Palestinians and destroyed much of Gaza could soon come to an end. All right. That's not all you know on this subject, Jim. So tell us what you think.
You know, I'm teaching a graduate seminar in diplomacy in this coming semester, and this, I think, I need to find a way to work this case study in to my syllabus. I need to change my syllabus quickly because it is such an interesting and timely case. Most times when people are saying, oh, you know, well, we need to kind of try diplomacy, they're saying, well, we need to talk instead of fight. But the reality, and we can see this reality in stark relief in this case, is that it's not really a question of talking versus all those other mean and nasty things. They're all rolled into one. And so what has taken a year and 3 months to get us to this point that people who study conflicts and negotiations maybe would call ripe for resolution, is a combination of intense diplomacy and talking, but it's also factoring in use of force, fighting, maneuvering with outside actors, the U.S., Qatar, the Turks, many others as well, the Egyptians, which I want to talk about later, and then also the role of domestic politics, which I think is what we are seeing now. I know that Netanyahu is saying that this holdup right now is because of Hamas, and that could well be partially the case. I suspect the bigger issue is the nature of the politics within his own cabinet, and particularly two of his ministers, Smotrich and Ben-Gvir, who have been against the idea of a ceasefire all along. And in fact, just last week, Ben-Gvir was boasting about how he had torpedoed many efforts at ceasefires up to that point, that it is simply not the way that at least these two ministers and their constituencies want to see this conflict go. And so I think that, you know, it could well be the case that the cabinet will ultimately vote for this, but it's an indication of how very fragile it is. And because we see this deal laid out in various phases, and after phase one, a lot of it is TBD, the TBD part is going to be really excruciating to get agreements on within the politics of the Israeli cabinet and the domestic politics of Israel, but also within the domestic politics among the Palestinians. There's so many unanswered questions. So I think, you know, it's good to see that there's been so much progress made, and it's important that the killing stops. That's important all around, and that hostages are returned, and politically important, but on a humane and humanitarian level, it's important. But it's, I think that this is really thin ice that everyone is skating on.
We get reports just from about an hour ago that deadly strikes in Gaza are continuing despite the announcement of the ceasefire deal. Also, that the White House has announced that they are aware of the concerns raised by the Israeli government and we're working to overcome them. John Kirby, the spokesman for the National Security Council, told NBC, "We're confident that we'll be able to solve these last-minute issues and get it moving." Libby Post.
Well, so I think these two guys who are holding everything hostage, in a sense, you know, there are only two votes on the entire cabinet, but this is Netanyahu walking a very fine line to be able to maintain his government. His government could collapse over this, which wouldn't be such a bad thing as long as more right-wing people don't end up being in the majority in the cabinet. The people of Israel, for the most part, want this over. They want the hostages back. What I found interesting is that the first phase of the deal, 33 hostages released and hundreds of Palestinian prisoners. Does that mean there are only 33 still alive? I mean, that's the question here. Why only 33? There were 200 and something taken. Some were Some were released last year. Some have been found dead. Some have been killed by friendly fire. And so really, are there only 33 hostages left? That's my question. And I
think that what I am seeing is that the estimate from the Israeli intelligence is mm-hmm. that there's 60-something that yeah. are still alive, but that Hamas doesn't want to give up all the hostages, particularly soldiers, IDF soldiers, in the first phase, because they're still...
But then Israel's supposed to give up hundreds yeah. of Palestinian prisoners,
yeah, yeah.
many of whom, you know... On the Palestinian side would like to blow up Israel.
Right.
So, you know, it's
but
like
nobody has a clear
act.
Sense of how many hostages really are still alive.
Well, I know.
And there's this that is also yes. a major flaw of this or major weak point of this deal. It's like what really
right,
is
because
the
no
deal?
One's, Israel's not getting the information that it needs. You know, there's, you know, who knows? We
there's
don't
no
know.
There's no monitoring
so,
built into
yeah.
it. No one like third party can really monitor
right,
these
right.
things.
Right. No, yeah. there is none. So. My thing is getting everybody released, getting all the hostages released. So I question why it's only 33 yet hundreds of Palestinian prisoners. And, you know, yes to the humanitarian aid. I think all of that has to happen. I think they, in good faith, Israel should stop bombing. Because really, what are they bombing? They're bombing empty shells of buildings. And
well, they
and,
killed 48 people
yeah,
in the most recent
killing more people.
Attacks.
Yeah. So, you know, they just need to stop because it's not making it any better. Now, here's what I think might happen. I think the deal will be sealed on January 21st, and Trump will take, because he's already taking credit for it, and Trump will take full credit for it. That's what I think is going to happen. I really, really do, as cynical as that sounds.
Do I have time to piggyback off of that?
Mm-hmm.
That was my first thought was, okay, this is probably too little too late, but you need to start somewhere. So this is obviously mm-hmm. probably the biggest breakthrough in the past 16 years in terms of putting an end to this. Most of what Jim said, I think, is accurate, that we're really on thin ice here. There's a lot of different phases and node points at which there can be disagreement, where the whole thing unravels, and then we're just back to square one. But thinking about Netanyahu and Trump, intelligent foreign leaders know how to play Trump. It's not a mystery at this point. And I think Netanyahu is probably he's probably got a very vested interest in delaying so that it can appear that he's working with Trump. He gives Trump the credit for making the deal happen.
Right.
And then all of a sudden, Israel has an even stronger ally with absolutely. The Trump administration.
Oh, absolutely.
And so I think there is strategic interests in Israel. And again, independent of the internal cabinet differences that are happening with the Netanyahu government, that more on the macro scale, that Netanyahu has a vested interest in delaying so that he can be seen visibly on the news, shaking hands with Trump, working with Marco Rubio and whoever else is involved, and giving Trump the victory
mm-hmm.
so that
yeah.
he knows he has
mm-hmm.
you know,
yeah.
an ally that is stronger than Israel's had in a long time.
Well, and you know, go ahead,
well,
Libby.
I mean, you know, Trump was always on Netanyahu's side. They're
oh, no, yeah.
they're the same person in a lot of different ways. I mean, you know, if Netanyahu is no longer in office, he's going to end up in jail. And, you know, there is that strong possibility because of ethics, and there's been a number of cases brought against him. And, you know, they don't have the Supreme Court that we do that just gave carte blanche to the president to do whatever they want. So, you know, I think that, you know, it will wait, and Netanyahu will bring Trump over for the signing and the whole nine yards. I mean, it's going to
yeah.
be a spectacle, and it's to keep Netanyahu out of jail and to, I mean, Trump's not going to jail. We all know that. But, you know, to keep him up there, we'll see in the long run how well that relationship will last. You don't have the Kushners out front like you did in the first administration.
Yet,
but we'll see. You know, it's...
But, you know, I also think that if we look at the kind of the carrots and sticks of diplomacy, the Biden administration, in some cases, to many people's estimation, not enough cases, but have tried to use some sticks on Netanyahu and say, well, you know, we're going to withhold this, or they ultimately didn't do any of that. And so I think it wasn't taken as credible. It wasn't taken seriously at all. But I think Trump is more likely, and his envoy who went out to Israel and also to Qatar, I think he's also providing some carrots. And one of the carrots is something that will become more obvious after Trump takes office and when we get to, if we do get to phase two of this deal. And as those details start to be put in place, I think it will be much more to the liking of Ben-Gavir and Smotrich and their constituencies. And that will have a lot to do with being able to annex parts, formally annex parts of the West Bank, and perhaps to physically control parts of Gaza, which has always been denied as a goal. But Smotrich and Ben-Gavir have said out loud time and again that that's what they want. And I think Trump will give them the green light to do that.
Absolutely.
So during the morning of President Carter, we were reminded again and again of the hostage release upon the inauguration of Ronald Reagan. And even though the Carter administration mm-hmm. had worked so hard on that and also had great tragedy in trying to end that, it wasn't until the hand was on the Bible that the hostages came out. I bring it up only because I guess this issue of credit is important, although we sort of all knew what happened then. We remember it however many years later as to what happened. And I just wonder, it's a lot of dogs and ponies.
But, you know, I mean, look, Donald Trump, he wanted to get credit for the biggest inauguration crowd
right.
in history, whether that was true or not. I mean, credit and something that matters a lot. That's the currency of his realm. And he learned that from the
size
of Roy Cohn.
Size is the currency of his realm. It's all a size thing for him.
I understand that. I guess what I'm driving at, though, is that in the, you know, of how history looks at it, is sort of saw it for what it was then and saw it for what it was now. And I wonder if that won't be the same case here.
Yeah, I think it's a highly relevant comparison. And I think we'll have a very dramatic day on Inauguration Day here and in the Middle East.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue talking about this, and we'll welcome your letters as well. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We always welcome your letters. We'd love to hear from you. We'll be back right after this short break. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. This morning we welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org, and we would love to hear from you. Letters on the subject, this subject and the others that we will be speaking of this morning, and we certainly welcome that, panel at WAMC.org, and we'll get to those in just a bit. I'm curious, as we look to the hope that we had even yesterday, I mean, I know it was always sort of it was going to be 42 days, and we didn't know how long that was going to last, and it was always contingent on the votes and so forth. But I think the world did allow itself a moment of what it would be like to have a deal reached and for there to be a peace deal. And so, but that was not enough, at least in the short term, to overshadow these issues that existed, right?
Yeah, well, and remember, this is not the first ceasefire within this conflict. We had one in November, I think just a month and a half
after
the initial attack. And that even almost as soon as it was struck, started to show real cracks. And there was hope that, you know, people could jump off of that and have a longer standing deal. And that didn't happen. In fact, it went the opposite direction. Mm-hmm. So that's a cautionary tale number one. And secondly, I think just in negotiations in general, that it is very rare that you have just kind of a definitive conclusion. Okay, this is over, particularly because this is trying to establish a ceasefire of a conflict that, I mean, it's immediately that its kind of range of negotiation is trying to deal with the conflict that followed October 7th, but it's part of a much broader conflict that is so complex and so deeply rooted, and there's so many different constituencies involved that there's just a lot of moving parts, and that means there's a lot that can go wrong at any moment.
Let's go to a letter from Melinda, who says Netanyahu will wait until Trump is sworn in, just like Reagan and Carter, with Iran hostages. Will that still have its own precariousness as far as being firm, do you think?
You mean when those hostages are released?
Not so much in that, even if an agreement comes and upon everything gets approved, there's still a lot to unfold.
Yeah, I mean, if one of the kind of, you know, the big questions is what is going to be the status of Gaza? How is Gaza going to be governed? By whom? And, you know, how is this all going to play out? And that is left completely unspoken to. And, you know, Anthony Blinken has said on the record over the past couple of weeks that, you know, he thinks that there ought to be some kind of deal where Hamas has no governing role and a reconstituted Palestinian Authority, both in the West Bank and Gaza, takes over. And, you know, Hamas, despite the fact that Netanyahu said that the Israelis were going to make sure that Hamas was completely eliminated and could have no role whatsoever, it has turned out that this conflict and the way the conflict has been carried out has actually increased the popularity of Hamas. Before October 7th, Hamas was deeply unpopular with the people in Gaza. And that's not just me saying it. There is data from a highly credible survey, the Arab Barometer, that showed that right before that conflict. And so you have a Hamas that's not only hasn't been eliminated, but actually support of its brand of governance has increased. And that's really highly unfortunate, but it has to be taken into account when you think of how are you going to run this place? Who's going to be in charge? Who's going to monitor it from the outside? What's going to be the role maybe of the Egyptians and others? I mean, all of those are left up in the air, and it's so that makes it really continuously precarious.
The precariousness has the fact that Hamas has suffered extraordinary military defeats, that Iran is largely weakened in all of this. There's another side to this that can play out, and it would rhyme with what happened in the early 1970s with the OPEC embargo of oil to the U.S. The U.S. is now a major player in international energy markets, particularly with oil, but the outsized role that Arab countries in the Middle East have in terms of being able to leverage their power of literally turning the oil spigot on and off can upset an already fragile economy, particularly with the inflation picture in the U.S. So, you know, if Trump goes all in with Netanyahu and that there are these, you know, really large concessions that are opposed in, you know, other countries in the Middle East, then when countries get military defeated, you know, they have a plan B. It's not, okay, we lost, there's an agreement we don't like, so we're just going to throw our hands up and say, well, this is what's agreed upon. I think there's, you know, the next phase of this, even if there's a ceasefire with very favorable terms for Israel, is that, and again, you know, there's the wild card of what's happening in Syria. And all of these other complexities that Jim pointed out, you know, do have the potential to lead to increased volatility in international energy and oil markets. And that has the potential, because we saw what happened with inflation and President Biden. Imagine if something like that happened, but on a much larger scale with President Trump, because of the hostility that's brewing in the Middle East and those in the OPEC countries waging economic warfare.
But I agree with all of that, except it's not at all clear to me that the oil-producing Arab states will unquestionably support the Palestinian people.
Sure.
Because right. The reality, historically, is that many of the Arab states have not, and that they have, in one way or another, found opportunities to cut out the Palestinians from various transactions, from various deals, from various new relationships that some of these relationships that the Trump people very much want to foster. So I think there's a lot of moving parts there that I'm not sure that those Arab states will fall in line in a
sure.
way that would be required for them to act in together.
Unison, particularly yeah. with what's happening in Saudi Arabia with MBS and that burgeoning relationship
right.
with the Trump administration, that, sure, yes, the picture is far more complicated than
73.
Right.
Yeah.
And we have to remember that Israel and Saudi Arabia were just about to ink a deal, right? Right before October 7th. And it's what, well, right after October 7th, they were right around that time. And that's part of the reason why this all happened, because Iran, as its proxy, you know, emboldened Hamas to do what they did. Now, Iran is definitely weakened now. Hamas is weakened now. Hezbollah, I don't even know if it still is around. You know, the Houthis are getting pummeled where they are. And so, you know, it'll be interesting to see how that all plays out and whether or not any of the Arab countries will stand up for the Palestinians. And I kind of doubt it. And I, you know, I don't quite understand the historical nature of why the Arab countries have turned their backs on the Palestinians for so long. I mean, it started in 48. I mean, why is there that dynamic?
Yeah, I mean, I think you have to take it country by country and, you know, historical incident by historical incident. There's not kind of one answer that says it all. But, you know, I often in conversation with people about, let's say, the Egyptian relationship with this Gaza conflict, there's oftentimes an assumption that the Egyptians must be supporting Hamas unconditionally. This is simply not true. And so you have to know a bit, not expecting people to always know it, but you have to know a bit about Egyptian domestic politics to know that the current Egyptian military regime ousted a Muslim Brotherhood freely elected, freely and fairly elected president in 2013. And following that, declared all members of the Muslim Brotherhood to be terrorists and therefore subject to deportation, arrest, or worse. Hamas is an outgrowth of the Muslim Brotherhood. And so the Egyptian government are not great friends, to put it mildly, of Hamas. And so that's just one example, Libby, of the complexities that intersect these kinds of issues.
All right. We have several letters. So let me get to these and we'll have enough time, I think, to get to all of them, at least all the ones that we have earmarked. What does Joe mean by that? Joe means by that that we never can get to every letter. However, we do try through the triage process of getting the mood of the room, mm-hmm. so that you may have 10 letters that say basically the same thing, and we'll pick one or two that sort of bring home that point. So it's nothing personal, is what I'm saying, because I know some of you take it very personally, and you shouldn't. You really, really shouldn't. Will says, it's hard to find an example of a conflict that comes to a definitive end without one side or the other being completely defeated. The biggest tragedy is this is going to happen again in the future. Somehow, we must find a different solution.
Yeah, I mean, I think what Will is talking about is that, you know, getting back to my, you know, I need to use this case in my diplomacy seminar, that, you know, there are certain negotiations that are negotiations because one side has been just massively militarily defeated. And that is not the case here, actually. So Will is quite right that if you don't get those larger issues of governance, of ultimately, you know, are we talking about a two-state solution, which seems like a pipe dream to many, or not? If you're not going to talk about those things, the idea that this will continue to come back and back and back does seem unfortunately highly likely.
We go to this letter from Norma. Obviously, the Israel government has so far not cared about Israel hostages, but we're more interested in committing genocide in Gaza and taking over the West Bank and Lebanon. War criminals must be charged and sentenced. That from Norma.
Then can I say one thing about that?
Course.
So Libby had mentioned that Netanyahu has charges against him, and he does have charges, domestic, I think, political and financial corruption charges against him. He also has a charge from the International Criminal Court of war crimes against him. And then the International Court of Justice also has, you know, opened the genocide case issue. I think also this intersects with some of the things that probably the Trump administration has held out as carrots behind the scenes to the Netanyahu people, that says that they will put maximum pressure on anybody who's going to try to enforce that International Criminal Court indictment. And, he, you know, Trump has already basically said this out loud, and that they're going to work to block the ICJ and the genocide case as well. So I'm sure that those are part of the conversations behind the scenes.
All right, we go back to the letters, and we go to John. You guys read a letter from me early last year. I don't remember, John. I'm so sorry. When Israel was bombing Gaza, I said there was a quote that said the only way of determining if you are winning against terrorists is if you are killing more terrorists than are being created. I asked the panel how they thought Israel was doing at that time. Now that Syria has fallen, Hezbollah and Hamas greatly damaged, how does the panel feel now about that question? Are we winning now just to have a huge wave of young terrorists arise in 5 years or so?
I mean, it's tough to argue that one side's winning and one side's losing, which, I mean, that's a sports metaphor where it's very clear, you know, they have more points than them, so win. You know, it's not, I mean, is, to the extent that one party in kind of the medium-term time frame comes out with a stronger position and stronger alliances, you could claim they win. So that could be Israel and Netanyahu with Trump, or it could be the Palestinians and these new forged what's the plural of nexus? Nexi? Nexuses? New forged alliances with other regions and terrorist organizations that, you know, perhaps yet don't exist. So, you know, I think that that's a false analogy to talk about who's winning and who's losing. I see John's point, but, you know, in the short run, sure, you could say that Israel's winning, but in the medium term and long run, if this war just continues to simmer or proceed at a low boil, and you've got these far off groups that are, you know, hijacking ships, you know, oil tankers that are carrying oil from the Middle East to the U.S., you know, all of that creates, I mean, in my opinion, everybody loses. Nobody ends up better off because of the situation.
And I think it defines it narrowly to just say, I mean, it's a good letter because it brings up lots of important issues, but to say, well, let's just talk about terrorists, I think that defines it too narrowly. So the letter writer is quite correct that Iran is in a weakened position. So I don't know if that's winning or not. I think on balance, that's a good thing for the region. That's a good thing for Israel. It's a good thing for the United States. The Iranian regime is this is a bad actor regime in many, many ways. And so that's one piece of it. But within Gaza and the West Bank as well, which we should not lose sight of, I don't know if it's a question of creating more terrorists, But what I would say is that you've created more people who feel like violence is their only resort, mm-hmm. that there's no political horizon. And if that's not held out as a real viable possibility and you're getting pummeled, you know, 46,000 plus Palestinians have been killed in Gaza over the last 15 months. It has, I mean, Anthony Blinken was saying it, it has created more people who feel like violence is their only option at this point. And that is deeply unfortunate.
All right. Back to the letters we go. And there is this one. Could someone on the panel refresh my memory as to the role of Ronald Reagan and the delay of releasing the American hostages until after the inauguration? What leverage did Reagan have with the Iranian
government? It was Iran that made the decision to wait, to make Carter look weak and try to forge a new relationship. Because I don't think Reagan got all that involved, although the Republicans might have.
Well, William Casey, who was then the campaign manager of the Reagan-Bush ticket.
And then the CIA.
Right. Seemingly without the knowledge or approval of the government, arranged a deal with Iran that said that in return for military equipment that the Iranians would not release the hostages until Reagan was at the inaugural. This has been written about going back to the early 90s. Gary Sick has written about this. So there is new information out that indicates that it's precisely what happened in newer testimonials. So as to what happened, but so that's basically the gist.
Yeah, yes. I mean, I think the claim also was that George H.W. Bush was involved in that as a former CIA director, and we could certainly see that the Reagan administration, once it was in office, was willing to secretly negotiate with the Iranians, and that blew up in their faces, but they did it. So, yeah, I think that there's that's a sordid tale as well.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it was so clearly political. I mean, it was so obvious that when that all came down, and when it was right after the inauguration, it was to, you know.
It makes for good theater.
Oh, yeah. It was very good political theater. And, you know, if Casey was involved, if Reagan may not have known anything, which is not far from the truth about it. But, you know, they did it. I think it was done by Casey, by Bush, to really embarrass the Democrats.
And make sure that Carter didn't have an October surprise victory.
Right. Yeah.
That could, you know, maybe swing the election. I don't think it probably could have been swung at that point anyway, but still, it was political as well.
If you would like to read more, there is a fascinating book that came out in October called Den of Spies, Reagan, Carter, and the Secret History of the Treason That Stole the White House. And that is by Craig Unger. He was on our show. That is online, but the book is out and is fascinating and tells that story. So there's your homework for today.
Well, there's a headline in the foreword, which is a Jewish daily that I get, because we were talking about the Kushners and what they're going to do yet, right? So Jared Kushner's investment firm is set to double its stake in an Israeli financial firm just days before his father-in-law, Donald, returns to the White House. That's from the Jewish Telegraphic Agency.
Least surprising thing I've heard all.
Yeah, right. I know. It's amazing. And boy, they're very tan. They've been living in Miami, and they're very, very tan.
All right. We'll... You know, sunscreen is always important, no matter who you're talking about. We'll take a break, and we'll come back to new topics. We have a lot to discuss. We thank you for your letters. They can keep coming on the new stuff. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll be back right after this news with Ray Graff. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Let me reintroduce our group to you. Jim Ketterer is here, a senior fellow of the Bard Center for Civic Engagement, professor of economics at Siena College, Aaron Pasitti, and political consultant and lobbyist Libby Post with us. And we thank all of them. We thank you for being a part of the program and joining us. It is always a pleasure to have you here. All right. Let us go to other issues and talk about other things that are making news. The president of the United States, at least for a few more days, is spoke last night to the nation in basically his farewell speech, and it was something. It was an address that warned that an oligarchy of ultra-rich in the United States threatens the future of democracy. And he warned of that oligarchy. And he spoke from the Oval Office, and he sees what is likely to be his final opportunity to address the country before he departs the White House to spotlight the accumulation of power and wealth in the U.S. among just a small few. Quote, today an oligarchy is taking shape in America of extreme wealth, power, and influence that literally threatens our entire democracy, our basic rights and freedoms, and a fair shot for everyone to get ahead, Biden said, drawing attention to a, quote, dangerous concentration of power in the hands of a few ultra-wealthy people and the dangerous consequences if their abuse of power is left unchecked. Who was he talking about? Invoking President Dwight Eisenhower's warnings about the rise of a military-industrial complex when he left office in 1961, Biden added, I'm equally concerned about the potential rise of a tech-industrial complex that could pose real dangers to our country as well. He used his 15-minute speech to offer a model for a peaceful transfer of power and, without mentioning Trump by name, raised concerns about his successor. Libby.
Well, I watched part of the speech and I read the article, and I think he's absolutely right. We are, it's like the Gilded Age, I don't know, 10.0? I don't know how to even put it, but it's like, you know, back in the day, in the turn of the last century, we had the robber barons, we had the train guys, we had all of that, and it was wealth was accumulated in a very small pocket, and the labor movement corrected that ultimately, right? Then we had the military-industrial complex that Eisenhower warned us all about, and people were like, "But he's a general; he should like the military." You know, people didn't quite—I don't think they quite got it until Vietnam, until the reporting came out about how companies, big corporations, were making so much money on the military stuff. And now we have this. And so it's this combination, because the military-industrial complex wasn't necessarily totally ingrained in government, right? They were getting contracts. They were talking. They were lobbying. They were doing stuff. But they weren't running the government. They weren't in the White House. They weren't at the left hand of the president. Now we've got Musk and Rosmani and all these other folks who really do want to create this oligarchy, but they are in the White House. And union membership isn't as, I mean, it's growing, but I don't know if there's the political awareness that there was at the turn of the last century, not this past century, but the one before, when the labor movement was really starting, because you had a lot of rank and file folks voting for Trump. We're going to end up having to see the consequences of all of this, right? And people are going to have to realize that, oh, eggs haven't gone down on January 21st, and the gas hasn't come down, and blah, blah, blah. And they're going to keep going up, because what they're trying to do is really create this us and them bifurcation within the economy. They really don't care. They're going to, if they go through with the tariffs, and they go through with all the throwing the documented and undocumented out of the country, who's going to pick the cotton? I mean, really, who's going to pick the fruit? Who's going to work in the fields? Not us, right? And So it's going to be interesting to see how that all plays out and whether people can understand what it is that they've done. But he's right. This technological industrial complex is trading in lies. You know, people call it disinformation, misinformation. Let's put it what it is. It's a lie. It's lies. They're peddling lies. It's like the guy who used to peddle bad medicine out of the back of a horse-drawn carriage, you know, and that's what we have. And people are buying it. People are believing it. And it'll be interesting to see if we can separate the wheat from the chaff here in terms of people finally realizing what's really going on, the rank and file, the folks that aren't listening to us necessarily, but are the ones who are paying much higher prices for eggs.
That misinformation campaign is ingeniously designed to tire people out, to make them feel resigned, to just exhaust the media, exhaust the public, precisely so that the oligarchs can just run rampant now that they are literally in the seats of government. I mean, if you look at Trump's cabinet, it's really impossible to imagine any other point in not only modern U.S. history, but U.S. history where you've had the robber barons in the seats
of
political power.
Right.
So to me, the misinformation and the, the L.A. fire department's throwing handbags on fires and blah, blah, all of that is just designed to distract people from what's happening, which is going to be the largest upward redistribution of wealth since the robber baron 1.0 era. So in terms of Biden's overall farewell address, I think the Biden presidency, in my opinion, is probably one of the most tragic in modern American history, but not for the reasons people might think. It's the most tragic because he has done the most for the country and the working class, yet has received the least amount of credit. If you look at his record, there was the $2 trillion American Rescue Plan, which coupled with the CARES Act, we got to give Trump and that Congress credit for the initial COVID response, gave the U.S. the strongest and fastest economic recovery from COVID in the world. There was the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act in November of 21, which was $700 billion to improve highways, broadband, the electrical grid, clean water. There was the Inflation Reduction Act, probably the biggest misnomer in legislative history, which is actually a healthcare and climate bill. He gave the government power to negotiate prescription drug prices. There was the student loan forgiveness. He sat on a United Auto Workers picket line. He strengthened the Federal Trade Commission to help, you know, again, a first step, not enough, but certainly a step in the right direction to limit the power of oligopolies and monopolies to charge consumers junk fees and to make those fees more transparent. There was a lot he didn't do, raising the minimum wage, universal child care. But when you look at what he did in that four-year period and how that perhaps doesn't immediately help the working class, but will over the next decade or so with investment. I forgot to mention the CHIPS Act. All of these things that are, and again, primarily benefiting workers in red states that have been, those deindustrialized, deunionized, opioid-injected communities, that what Biden did is remarkable. I mean, you really have to go back to FDR to think of a more pro-labor, pro-middle class policy. The middle class needs to be created. History shows us, going back to hunting and gathering times, that without an activist government, you will not have a middle class. You will have the aristocracy and everybody else. Right. And it wasn't until after World War II that it was, okay, we need pro-labor legislation. We need to strengthen unions. We need to raise the minimum wage. We need a safety net. Biden did more to strengthen that than you could argue Lyndon Johnson, but to me, that's why it's the most tragic, is he did the most and gets the least credit. And what he will go down for in at least the public consciousness, historians might differ, is, but the inflation.
Right.
Which was a COVID Russia-Ukraine related phenomenon. It has nothing to do with Biden. I shouldn't say nothing. A little bit
but
to do with
know,
Biden policies.
I'm interested in Libby's opinion on the other part of the what makes it tragic is that I mean that record is certainly the case, but it seems to me that this was an administration that just for whatever reason did not have the capacity to get the message out. And I don't fully understand how and why that happened.
I think part of it was the perceived weakness, just general weakness of Joe Biden himself. Old, whatever.
I was going to say weakness and age.
Yeah, weakness and
or
age.
Both.
And so that message kept going out from all different kinds of places. And it was sort of hard to refute because it's true, right? I think part of it is Jen Psaki left. She was good. The woman who's there now is fine, but honestly, I hate to put it this way, but the press corps is still pretty white and male, right? And especially the Fox folks and, you know, all that. She's a short lesbian woman of color. And so I think that some of these folks thought they could run roughshod, as well as the right-wing media attacking her constantly for being a woman of color and a lesbian, right? And so I think that was part of the dynamic there. But I also think that they were so busy doing their job that they forgot that making sure the message got out was also part of their job. And the media but doing what they thought was their job, which was to raise questions and to speculate as to the veracity of what any politician says. And so you put all of that together, it was sort of a perfect storm. And the Democrats, the problem with the Democrats, and I am one of them, is that we still think people are going to respond to logic. And it's just not true. It's values and emotions. And it really needed to be framed. His whole 4 years needed to be framed within that. You'll see Trump going after people's emotions constantly. And that's what he does. And that's why he's successful.
How much of that, this is a question to both of you, another thing that I thought of was that how much of the lack of Biden taking credit or the marketing or the PR aspect of this is just the pendulum. He's, you know, with Trump took credit for everything and everything.
Right.
So how much of that was just a reaction to let's kind of try to reset the counter on this one.
It's possible that that was part of it, too. It's a shame that this is how it all worked out. You know, I think, honestly, I think that if Harris had been the nominee for 6 months, the outcome might have been different. But in 3 months, she put together a hell of a campaign.
I think so, yeah.
But nonetheless, we came up short. But there is no
just
mandate.
Just 1.5%
right.
short.
There is no mandate here, right? He didn't win by a landslide. We'll see how many people show up for his inauguration. And now with AI, we may never know. Right? Because you can just do what you need to do and create the visuals that you need to create. But, it is a shame that they didn't get the message out coherently and consistently enough and that the media didn't pick it up. And that's part of it, too. Mm-hmm. And the media itself is under siege. Newsrooms, local newsrooms are getting smaller and smaller. We see the Washington Post being owned by Jeff Bezos, which, you know, they didn't do the endorsement and he wants the contract to go into space. Then you have hedge funds owning major newspaper chains. It's really not as vibrant as it once was.
And one thing that FDR, I don't think, had to deal with, or LBJ, or even Bill Clinton, is such a highly organized ecosystem of right-wing media that has existed before but is
like
more
this.
Omnipresent, more coordinated, is coordinated with right-wing think tanks, with right-wing podcasts now, and I mean, it really seems like it's very difficult, even when there is the positive message you were talking about, Aaron, and these real accomplishments that just can't get beyond this overwhelming right-wing ecosystem of media, think tanks, et cetera.
And the 24/7 news cycle doesn't help, you know, because they've got to fill it with something.
There's been a sea change since.
Yeah.
You can see the beginnings of it with Bush, kind of Obama. I mean, but like, yeah, this is fundamentally a different landscape. And the people who know how to master and leverage that landscape for their own benefit are the ones who will succeed.
Yeah.
Say what you want about Trump. He knows how to work a crowd and work a camera.
And
like, that's why he won. It's not because he's a brilliant, you know, policy wonk or has these novel ideas to help regrow the U.S. He uses that media infrastructure Jim was referring to you know, enrich his oligarch buddies.
Right, and to his total advantage. I mean, this morning I was, in between reading our stories, I was looking at some stuff, and I think it was Megyn Kelly was on Fox or something, and it was in the video in the Post saying about the fires, the L.A. fires. Well, that fire chief, she's a lesbian. Women don't want lesbians to save us. We want strong men. And I'm like, are you kidding me? You know, really? This is what you're going to? But this is what they do. They focus on that shiny object over there so that they can fool everybody else. Because they're looking at that shiny object, but really, on to the right, but really what's going on to the left of you is what's going to undermine your ability to provide for your family.
So the last inflation report of President Biden's administration was released this week. What should we make of that, and how does that add to the what we will put into the books as far as his legacy goes?
Again, the tragic part about the Biden presidency is that what he will be remembered for is not his accomplishments, but inflation. The inflation that happened under Biden was due to a complex storm of COVID-related anomalies that happened in every country, every advanced economy in the world. It's not unique to the U.S. The spike in food prices and inflation and oil prices in early 22 and 23, that's the war in Ukraine and the unsettling of international food and energy markets. So Biden will be remembered for inflation, even though it's not his fault. What we saw in the report, which was the report that was released yesterday for December of 24, was that on a year-over-year basis, inflation rose 2.9%, which was higher than most economists expected, but you know, largely consistent with what you would see in a strong, growing economy. It's above the Federal Reserve's 2% target, which is, it needs to be said, arbitrary. The Federal Reserve has agreed on a formal 2% inflation target because it's a number that is low enough to make people not feel the pinch of inflation, but high enough to serve as a buffer against deflation and depression. So whether it's 2.9, 2.6, 2.1%, to economists is really irrelevant. I mean, to money managers, those tenths of a percent matter. But, you know, for your average consumer, that's an inflation rate that is consistent with a strong labor market where unemployment is just a hair above 4%, strong GDP growth, abundant job opportunities. Wages have been increasing faster than inflation for now a year and a half. Nobody remembers that. What they remember is $5 a gallon gasoline in the winter of 2022, and boy, egg prices now are through the roof. Okay, again, Russia and bird flu. These are things that are beyond any individual president's control. So no president in modern U.S. history, Nixon, granted he did, no president in modern U.S. history has served more than a single term when inflation happened under their watch. Nixon, that's a different story because of Watergate. Ford, Carter, and now George W. Bush, H.W. Bush, one term, but not for different reasons. And now Biden. Presidents don't survive inflation because it affects everyone. Unemployment and recessions only affect the unemployed. Right. That's a fraction of the population. The pain people, the real pain people feel at grocery stores, the gas pump, and everywhere else affects everyone. It affects every voter. Mm-hmm. So that's why presidents don't survive bouts of inflation. So that's what Biden will be remembered for, despite, you know, a COVID-related anomaly that would have happened whether Trump got reelected in 2020 or, you know, somebody else got elected in 2020. So the thing that Teresa keeps hounding, and I want to double down on this, is that, you know, people are unhappy at Biden for the inflation that happened under his watch. Well, the formal policies that Trump is already setting in motion, the tariffs, which is just the tax on imported goods.
Right, that we pay for.
That we pay for, and we'll pay for it twice over because countries just don't take that sitting down. Then they tax U.S. goods,
right,
which reduces our exports. So you get higher priced imports and fewer exports, which can lead to unemployment. That's going to be inflationary and bump up unemployment. The whether it's mass deportations or immigration restrictions, that limits the labor supply, which puts upward pressure on wages. And as Libby pointed out in the beginning of the show, those workers work in jobs that won't be filled by U.S. workers, right? These are the sub-minimum wage jobs that are largely off the books happening in food processing plants and agriculture. So if you think food prices are high now, you just wait a couple of years. And then there is the tax cut, which will largely be deficit financed. It won't stimulate growth. Without getting into the minutia of how bond markets work and how deficits come to be, that will have the effect of being inflationary. So Biden's accidental inflation is one thing. The formal inflation people are going to feel under Trump is another. And it's important to note that we're not going to see a spike in inflation because of Trump's policies. It will be a slow rolling boil where you're not going to feel it all at once. But mark my words, if his policies get put in place the way he's describing them now, 4 years from now, inflation's going to be more entrenched around 4% and 5% than it is around 2% and 3%.
All right, this is a great cliffhanger moment. So you got the facts out. That's great. Now let's discuss it. We'll do that, but we have to take a break first, and we will do so. And then we'll be back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. I'll ask go around with this group before we have to say goodbye to them in about 15 or 20 minutes. I mean, not forever, just for, you know, today. They'll be back at some point in this iteration. We welcome you to be a part of the program. Panel at WAMC.org. Okay, so before we left, we got an in-depth, really amazing report on what these latest economic numbers mean regarding inflation and regarding our economy from Aaron. Before I go to the rest of the group, is there anything else you wanted to add to that? Okay, and then you were going to make a comment.
Oh, well, we talked about it on the break.
Well, the people didn't hear that.
I know. I think the business community will push back on the tariffs. And he does sort of listen to the business community because he's a business person and it's about profit for him. So I was just wondering, and we talked about this, can reiterate how that will play out.
He will impose tariffs. The question is, how large will they be? How widespread will they be? And will there be any retaliatory tariffs from the countries that are imposed upon? As Jim pointed out off air, some tariffs are good, but those tariffs need to be so large that they may that it's a legitimate barrier to buying the goods. So if the U.S. is trying to develop a domestic solar panel manufacturing industry, you need to impose 100%+ tariffs on imported solar panels. That could be the same. The CHIPS Act was designed to do that. So there are very logical arguments for tariffs because some of the Trump tariffs, the Biden-Harris administration kept in place. But I don't think Trump is thinking about tariffs in those terms. I think he's thinking about tariffs as with kind of blinders on, that if they win, then we lose. So
right.
If we,
yes,
it's a zero-sum game.
Right, zero-sum.
So if we raise tariffs, they send us more money than they were, therefore we're winning. Now, Libby asked about the business community, because if you're taxing imports and then, you know, businesses rely on imports for, you know, raw materials and intermediate parts in production, won't they object to that? And the answer is yes, but not in the way you think. The Treasury Department accepts applications and petitions for special tariff exemptions on a case-by-case basis. So this happened in Trump's first term, where the biggest, most profitable companies who can afford lawyers and lobbyists to file those petitions will be the ones who get exempt from those tariffs. And, you know, then you can see Trump and the CEO just shaking hands mm-hmm. on a pedestal, you know, in front of a lectern and just, you know, forging ahead. Meanwhile, small businesses who can't afford that are going to be the ones who will bear the cost. So he will go through with it, but behind closed doors and through the long legislative process, many, many companies, the biggest, most profitable ones who can afford tariffs the most, will be the ones who get exempt from it.
I have a question, Aaron. Back to inflation and the relationship between inflation and interest rates and the role of the Fed and what Trump has said out loud over quite a span of time, that he wants to personally be more involved in Fed's decisions and have more of an influence over that. So how do you see that playing out as he's about to come back into power?
Yeah, that's the – to me, that is an issue more important than his tax cuts. That's more important than immigration policy and more important than the tariffs. Because the Fed – the Federal Reserve, the central bank of the United States, is the one institution that informally serves as a check on presidential and congressional overspending. Politicians get votes by spending money and cutting taxes. Both of those things are inflationary. So if we don't want inflation running rampant, we have this institution, the Federal Reserve, who can decrease the supply of credit, raise interest rates, to contract economic activity, to make borrowing more expensive, which people don't like, but it prevents inflation from happening. There was a Fed chairman, and I forget his name, but he said the job of the Fed is to take away the punch bowl once the party just starts to get fun, right? So
I know that person.
Yeah.
So politicians don't like the Fed. And politicians normally just stay quiet about the Fed. They know it's good for the long-term health of the economy, economic stability. Trump is bucking that trend. And if you start making the Federal Reserve a political organization, we end up with the economic equivalent of what the Supreme Court is now, which is mm-hmm. just a bunch of lackeys that do whatever a president tells them to do. Now, this is where I think the business and finance community will draw the line. He might say that, and he might publicly call out Jerome Powell for being a moron or not understanding how interest rates work. I believe because of how important the Fed is to maintaining economic stability and therefore the profits of the financial sector, his appointee for Treasury Secretary, people like Jamie Dimon, and the finance and business community will say that is a step too far. Don't do that. And there's nothing preventing Trump and Congress from changing the Federal Reserve Charter. But I believe that this is where the business community would dig their heels in and say, you cannot do this. Because, I mean, at that point, that is the end of, you know, the United States as any type of functional country, let alone democracy.
Well, I'm glad I asked.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, that took a turn, didn't it?
Yeah, so that's Alexander Hamilton, right?
What?
Didn't he set up the National Bank, the Federal Reserve?
Hamilton was in favor of a national currency and a strong federal government, but it was Woodrow Wilson who passed the Federal Reserve Act, which really just formalizes that concept and takes it to a modern level.
And does Trump appoint Okay.
So to say that politicians don't have influence on the Fed is a bit of a misnomer, because the Federal Reserve's Board of Governors and the chair of the Fed are all appointed by the president and have to be confirmed by the Senate. So you could, but the way that those terms, there's seven members of the Board of Governors with a term expiring every 2 years. So it's staggered. So it would be almost impossible, even for a two-term president, to fully stack the deck of the Federal Reserve's governing body. And it's designed that way intentionally to prevent political influence. Because what if we have a temperamental president who wakes up one morning and his approval ratings are low and says, boy, I really need the, and you know, the stock market's coming down. I need to juice this economy. So we're going to lower interest rates by 2%. Good for him and good for his approval ratings and people who own stocks. But then you have rampant inflation and countries that don't have independent central banks or countries like Venezuela and Zimbabwe and all of these other countries, you can even throw Turkey into the mix, that as soon as politics gets involved with central banking, entrenched inflation is just around the corner. Uh-huh. That's the Trump's political interference and trying to exert more political control over the Fed's day-to-day operations, to me, is more important and more of a threat to the long-term health of the U.S. economy than the tariff, immigration, and tax cut policy combined.
All right. We will go on to a few other, at least another one other issue before we have to break in a few moments. And I want to, where do I want to go? I had this whole.
There's so many good ones.
I had this whole red dye number three thing that I wanted to, but we'll hold off on that. What does the idea of, so we lose TikTok or we save TikTok? The Biden administration is apparently, Trump is angling to save TikTok from a ban with an executive order. This, according to the Washington Post and an exclusive they had. So what does it benefit us to not have TikTok, to have TikTok?
Oh, that's a tough question. The argument for having TikTok is a competitive argument, right? That it is an alternative form of social media that's not owned by a Silicon Valley oligarch. Okay, that's a fair argument. But, you know, again, that's still an oligopoly where it's like, well, there's Meta and there's TikTok. Great. So that's not really a true choice.
Oligopoly.
The argument against it, there's a lot. You know, there's the, what a lot of U.S. senators are saying is that, well, the Chinese are harvesting data about, you know, the U.S. and people who are posting information. That's true, too.
So is Meta.
Yeah, exactly. No. Right. The issue is that since ByteDance, TikTok's parent company, is owned by a Chinese company and that algorithm they use is now part of China's national economic security infrastructure, meaning it can't be foreign-owned or exported, is that that algorithm can be tweaked to affect what users see on TikTok. So in the run-up to the 2024 election, I forget who did the study, but they found that stories about the economy, when the unemployment rate was at a 50-year low, stories that painted the economy in a bad picture outnumbered stories about, you know, it was always, well, the $30 dozen of eggs outnumbered good news economic stories by a factor of 2 to 1. So that's the argument I think that a lot of people would agree is that, you know, you can affect U.S. ideology by tweaking the algorithm to affect what U.S. users see.
Isn't, I think, the head of TikTok is going to be attending the inauguration?
Yes. Yeah.
Yes.
And let's not forget Trump's about face about this. He was all against national security until,
right, because the algorithm was more anti-Trump than it was pro-Trump.
And then he gets popular. He discovers he gets popular.
Right.
And then Jeff Yass, one of the Republican mega donors who contributed $46 million to the to super PACs and the presidential campaign in 2024 alone, came out and had a little meeting with Trump at Mar-a-Lago. He owns 15% of ByteDance, or he's got a 15% investment stake in ByteDance. And after that meeting, Trump does a 180. So, again, transactional politics.
And Trump was able to use it really effectively to get to young men and to build up the toxic masculinity factor in this campaign.
Now, what does Elon Musk think about all this?
that's a good question.
It's another major platform.
It's fundamentally a different platform than X is. It's video.
Yeah.
It's, what's the word I'm looking for? It's digital content based instead of just words based. Like, X is for, 100 and, well, what's the limit now? 280 words?
It was 140, 280, yeah.
280 words?
Oh, no, 280 characters.
Characters, sorry. I don't think he cares much. I don't think he will be affected, but that's a...
I don't think that he's looking to make money on X. I think he has it for other reasons. If he were looking to make money, he would have run it in quite a different way.
All right. We are out of time. My thanks to our great group this morning. We got to a lot of stuff, and we thank you. Jim Ketterer, Aaron Pasitti, and Libby Post, you're all wonderful. I appreciate your contributions to this morning's program. Thank you. We'll be back with more program right after this.